being able to put your finger on the things that seem like instruments of destruction and oppression, all of those things. But if we can sort of put our finger on the tools that are used to do that, how do we then also identify the things that make those tools necessary? Because we can destroy the trackers, but we're not destroying why the trackers exist.
But do we destroy the tractors tomorrow?
Do we?
Yeah.
Probably not.
It's not in the schedule. It was
a
schedule joke.
It's not.
Save 15 minutes. No, all right. Since we did save 15 minutes on this part of the exploration, what are the needs that are necessary?
Oh,
what is
the desires and the ideology. So, like, the terraforming of the land.
Quoting, you said that quote in the beginning that was really great, that we're living in the utopian dreams of colonial ancestors.
Kyle Thomas White.
Okay, yeah. I thought that was a good beginning that you said, too.
And also, like, I kind of hate to be the person to, like, bring Foucault into a discussion like this, but there was in a series of lectures and an interview, there was, like, one statement that seems to kind of relate to this in a way, where he was asked about the relationship between architecture oppression. And the interviewer was kind of in some ways suggesting that, like, oh, if we had different kinds of architecture, we would have less oppression. If we had different ways of designing spaces, we can sort of design our way out of oppression. And his response was sort of like, no. Like, oppression isn't the result of design. You can't, like, design your way out of oppression. Oppression is political. It's not a design. The design doesn't precede the oppression. The oppression makes the design necessary for the oppression. And that, I think, somehow relates to how I've been thinking about what it is these machines mark, I guess.
Did anybody catch the justification for the invention? What was the here on this wall?
The
needs equal invention or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That.
Necessity
is
there.
It's out of necessity. The Plato quote?
Yes,
yeah.
Plato, yes.
Necessity, invention happens out of necessity or something?
Yeah. Yes.
But then they turn what the necessity they want you to think they're meeting with this, right? They're
yes.
Like, oh, we're feeding the world,
yep.
We're producing, the reason
jobs.
Why there is hunger in these parts of the world is because they don't have roads
yep.
And bridges and, as if, and of course they're like, oh, and we just happen to make the machines that both like could be used for farming and the construction of the roads that we're saying you need
yeah.
To grow these monocrops.
And the clearing of the land.
Exactly.
But actually, a lot of hunger is about post harvest spoilage and waste and not being able to, and not having the infrastructure to move the food to the people who need it. I mean, so that's not negligible.
Sure, but that also that framing of that kind of infrastructure being a necessary part of meeting those needs, I think,
yeah,
is
totally.
Not an unproblematic
yes.
One. In that the reason why you have spoilage in those kind of things related to storage is because you have centralized food systems that are about producing large numbers of products that then need to get stored and shipped. Or
right,
food.
As
I mean,
opposed
but
to like subsistence.
Or
just small
of,
scale.
Yeah.
I did want to say though that it's really interesting to point out that the ideology brought the machines into being. But now the machines exist.
Yeah.
And there's an incredible inertia. Not only do the machines exist, but the landscape exists, And so I'm interested in what in combination with
well, I guess that's, I don't know that I have a lot to say, but
no,
maybe as a thing to point that other people might have about that is I feel like that's some of what the conversations that we've been having that do have to do with how we relate to one another and the life ways that exist in the places that we also exist in different ways is like, I guess it's a conversation, it's a negotiation. And so like it's not a, maybe that's like why I brought in the design solutions is we're not gonna design our way out of
right.
the problem. It has to be negotiated with others.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings.
It's relational.
About any kind of events, it's sort of this like a
they
public
really
place to celebrate.
Have, formal events here. They'll have like kids learn about Farming Day kind of thing, and you come in and there's like chickens.
There's people taking their homecoming photos.
Yeah,
that's
what I was asking.
So,
why would
here?
People do that?
Well, I mean, I live. And it's interestingly out in what used to be farmland, like this big suburban area called Pleasant Valley.
Pleasant Valley.
But it actually was originally, it was originally inhabited by white people, but there was a big Mexican-American settlement there in the 50s and 20s, which is sort of interesting. And that's gone. And they're the wealthiest school district. Not that I care. But it's really interesting how, you know, if you look at even just the landscape around the Quad Cities and what it looks like now, it's also produced by deer.
I wonder what you, think about the one of, probably people saw it, like, one of the last displays, like, on that end of the building, on this side of the wall that's about the autonomous tractor.
Yeah.
And there's a quote in there that essentially says that, like, the reason why that's such an innovative, necessary thing is because it allows essentially a land manager to efficiently operate this machinery, because one of the main costs is labor, right? And so this is like a way of removing that, but still giving the land manager control. But thinking about that relative to class and labor in this also is like seeing that and thinking about, because it's also reflected in the rural landscape, in that part of the efficiencies that these machines have always moved towards is requiring fewer and fewer people to work larger amounts of land.
Which is the result of policy. I mean,
right.
Because in 1966, there was a congressional, they put together a huge committee to study efficiency in farming in the U.S. And this had like pages and pages, lists of people who were on it, and they were all corporate industrial heads, except one person had to do with agriculture, which was the head of King Ranch, the biggest ranching operation in Texas. And what they concluded, they said the problem with American agriculture is there's too many people in it, and it's not efficient, and that it informed policy to get people out of agriculture and into, you know, industry, and to mechanize agriculture, you know, all the more. So, I mean, I know there are a lot of forces. There's like the ideology you're talking about. There's production modes like Fordism informing it, but also this policy.
Yeah.
This, like, you know, I mean, and then as Wendell Berry says, what are people for?
Space, because from a little bit of what I understand is actually that the museum, this whole pavilion, was part of a project to sort of rebuy and rebuild up to like something like 40 acres of land that had been abandoned from factories being closed down in the 80s. So actually, and they've been trying to make that happen for a long time, and then they ultimately were able to use this as an anchoring point for being in other building projects, development projects. And so it actually seems to me like it's like the especially the kind of the description of technology, the way in which even the automated, the autonomous tractor is almost, I mean, I know Deere, it does still command this position in farm implements, machinery and the world, but at the same time, that vision of that driving the global economy or being, that they may compete the world. I mean, that's something that already, it seems like it's harping back to like, 50 years ago as a kind of dominant rhetoric. So it seems like this bizarre, like on the one hand, this is more of a monument to industrialization, and the narrative in there seems more of a narrative of trying to recuperate a promise that they could deliver on that has proven yet over and over again that it doesn't deliver. The problem with agriculture is overproduction.
Yeah.
So it's not having bigger, better machines doesn't mean that's actually, it's like, that's not the issue. Producing, like, being able to feed all the people and getting what's been harvested to people is not the problem. The problem is capitalism and overproduction.
Well, unless being overproduced is it?
Right, because it's not profitable
it's
to
not
do that.
Well, also, there's the reverse subsidy system.
Yeah, but the subsidy system actually really is yeah, it's built into the speculative market, which is what
totally.
Actually, yeah, so.
Totally, but that's what all this farmland is
right.
is being corralled for.
Right, and it becomes more, as anything, the kind of financialization of global capital. It seems like it's more concrete because it has to do with the land, but actually it's as much with the intangible market.
Maybe
instructive
to consider some differences between, we're talking about Caterpillar here, and John Deere. And
fossil fuels, because if we, you know, what's going to happen to this mechanized agriculture? I mean, there's the story of Cuba, which is mythologized in many ways, but that, you know, when the Soviet Union crashed and cut off all their subsidies, they couldn't practice industrial agriculture like they had. Now Cuba imports about 80% of its food, but the question in my mind is like, how can this is so unsustainable on that level, and what's going to be the next transformation in response to a carbon loaded atmosphere? Anybody got an answer?
That's an easy one.
5 minutes.
Well, I think
you're
it's
sort
just
of presenting an answer
is definitely
in some ways.
Well, it's presenting an answer. I mean, it seems like this, what you see happening on sort of local levels, not just in the sort of more kind of rarefied, you know, organic markets, but it's like cooperatives, local. I mean, look what's happening to different kind of farm and food justice movements in different cities throughout. That seems to me actually that's where you see a response happening. It's not necessarily the response that is a kind of complete global transformation, but it's actually how in kind of these small scale places that have been abandoned in different ways that people come together to feed themselves.
Totally, like Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit's a great example.
It's a good example, yeah. And I know people in the Midwest, where we are, or in the Chicago area, have been working on creating an organic distribution network, because the distribution is so corporatized and centralized and tied up, it becomes a big barrier for small producers. And I don't know where that is at this point.
We talk a lot about an agroecological model. Talk about alternatives. I don't really know that much about it, but that seems to be a keyword. Throughout Latin America, it's used as a keyword.
Mm-hmm.
That would be worth looking into.
You know about the framework of agroecology?
Yeah.
Well, that's where, I mean, that's what the sort of like, again, like Lance has made Olivia Campesina hang up with all that, sort of creating a broad network.
This reminds me, in Atlanta, there's a Coca-Cola museum. I mean, I think it's a corporate, you know, like the big ones. It's almost like a necessity to create a kind of swag center, you know, and like where you can buy the swag and and promote your brand.
It's a brand thing. I mean, it's like the laboratory of the brand. The brand is a lot more than this building or this display.
But it's getting consumed so well in this building.
It sure is. But it's really, I mean, the actual logo of the deer is so powerful. It's filled, you know, so many commercials, prospectuses, loan offers, you know, guides to your robotic or cybernetic console inside the cabin. I mean, the logo is always there, and it's condensing the whole process of the company into this logo as a communications vehicle. You know, and this is the display center of that, and probably where they innovate. You know, they trap their new communication strategies.
It just redid it like.
A question I kind of had too. I mean, I kind of wonder too. What do you do when like a cultural identity of like a people and a place is wrapped up in a corporation
that
doesn't necessarily have a lot of goodwill towards those people? You know, like how do you solve that? How do you sort of convince them to move away from that without it being seen as an attack on them in a way too?
Excellent question.
I mean, I feel like it's the same thing that's happening with Line 3 in Northern Minnesota. Like, you can't separate it.
Yes.
Like John Deere's jobs, Line 3 promises jobs, though it's like you're not going to go to local jobs.
But again,
in places where like economic struggle is so like powerful, how can you convince without providing jobs or other economic needs?
But Deere's not really delivering that anymore in terms of a local. I mean, it was like in the 80s, the massive downsizing of their production here. So it's I think it's more actually on a symbolic level of what it, like what we're talking about, even in terms of a working class set of identities, of kind of the whole, and then the whole kind of agrarian myth of the United States that get attached to that, the branding. Because actually in terms of, I mean, there still is some production going on here, but it's nothing on the scale that it was. And I don't know.
Have they outsourced, maybe I've talked about this, have they outsourced the production of their machines?
Yes.
Yeah, where's the, did they talk about it in there?
I asked Dave.
Uh-huh.
You asked Dave?
Dave said there's no machine, they don't produce any machinery anymore. This is globally outsourced. So there's parts of the harvester are done in Spain, for
yeah.
example.
There's a photo of all the international workers.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, Corinne was saying, I mean, there's like the difference between, in terms of the cultures, from again not knowing a whole lot, like the difference between the corporate culture of International Harvester and Deer, and the two being like Harvester being sort of more progressive in a certain way, like as in Democrat progressive, and Deer being more like conservative, as in Republican conservative, and the split, and that actually being the idea. So even seeing on a small scale the kind of juxtaposition of those two, that like the way in which a corporate one's identity being tied to the corporate facility in a particular way, you see, from what I understand, that kind of split division here across the river, like Rock Island versus, I don't know if that's still something that's a thing I just.
You can just dial up the location of the John Deere production facilities, design facilities around the world. They're covering, you know, well, all five continents, with a big concentration in Europe, North America, and a smaller one in Latin America. Here, what you have typically for a corporation like this is design, research, design, management, and branding. That's what corporate HQs do. The idea that they're doing less production, I think, is quite false. Look at the amount of
aren't
things
less production.
Yeah, exactly. Now here they produce those things, which are a crucial part of production. Production is also marketing. I mean, they are producing a lot here. They're producing the capacity to manage that stuff all around the world. That's serious production.
Yeah,
I mean,
talking about in terms of a kind of a scale of jobs.
Yeah, I know you may be talking about that, but we often tend to think that things are deindustrialized. It ain't the case. There's industry growing around the world like crazy, and a lot of it is being managed out of places like this. So that's not just finance, that's production.
That's not really the point I was making.
When we're thinking about the company town and all the influence financially that John Deere has over this area, I keep thinking about Vernon and Crawford County, where Organic Valley is a cooperative, has such a huge influence. Funding the schools and a lot of the arts and culture and hospitals, and so just kind of interesting to think of that model, and also a model that strategically pushed back on industrial agriculture, the
they have prices for all the actual elements that we can buy the each of these differences, how much they cost. So it's like a shopping center, a church,
showroom. Shopping center,
church,
showroom.
It's a showroom, yeah.
Nice to get your
it's really beyond the
that
experience.
That's
experience.
That's all that.
Like, cool things like this. Yeah, and production of ideology. Sophisticated, I think.
It's also a little bit of a 3D puzzle, right? Where you get all this, these machines into one room, I guess.
Yeah, right.
So I'm from the River Group, and obviously, to us, if I may speak for the group, it's interesting how it would be interesting to know how the river relates to deer, and what perhaps would, in that sense, also be interesting for us. Again, I take the liberty to speak for the group. Is that so? We have a sense that there's a conversation between a set group of people, and we are sort of coming into this and as listeners, but we would also perhaps appreciate if there could be like some attempts to have a more collective approach to things, because we have some really interesting and brilliant students here and people who come from far, and it would be nice if there would perhaps also be a sense of what this field station how it relates to the other field stations and what it's been doing, so that there's an opportunity for others to also come in.
Great question.
Mm-hmm.
Super.
Well, I mean, I can give one attempt just because this was a place that I suggested and thinking about how maybe some of those concerns could be like reframed relative to both the questions of the Anthropocene that people people are engaging, and this particular landscape, that when you think about the Mississippi and framing the Mississippi as a river, it's where for us that that territory as a watershed is quite vast, and so narrowing that to just like where the current banks of the Mississippi River are was never anything we were particularly interested in doing. But thinking about like this particular site and where most of the stuff that I've been doing, which is a few hundred miles east of here, but is most definitely part of the Mississippi River watershed, and the these machines being the only reason why they can function is that in that landscape have to do with these why we're interested in the colonial Anthropocene is that in this set of policies, as Claire brought up, the importance of policies, for example, the Swampland Acts that were initiated in 1850 and then really didn't get mobilized until between 1870 and 1930, when the combination of technological development but also the sort of entrepreneurial allies of the colonial nation state, given lands that were stolen through forced removal and displacement and, direct military campaigns and otherwise, and that these machines are able to function in that landscape because they were so drained, right? And I brought up James C. Scott's work at the beginning and the way that he sort of frames wetlands as ungovernable spaces for nation states. That I think is also like kind of a very true story, even though he doesn't talk about this part of North America, at least like not in the stuff that I've read. A lot of what he has to say about that to me resonates with how I understand that history. And the long-term results of that that work of the colonial nation state, both like, initially populating with settlers following the forced depopulation, or attempted forced depopulation. And then this other kind of second kind of depopulation that's happening with these machines functioning through these ideas of efficiency, all also rely on eventually this waterway, taking a lot of this stuff to New Orleans, where a lot of these conversations will also continue, right? And so that, I guess the relationship between water and land and the life ways that sort of inhabit them in messy ways, and like that these machines and the production of monocrops are one way of governing that space by the colonial nation state. And so those histories are like sedimentary for me. And so I can't now think about monocrop corn and soy as just some capitalist problem that has to do with industrial agriculture. It also is connected to removal and displacement and that making available the ability to then engineer the landscape to then create agricultural processes that these machines are able to function in. I'm not sure how much like what I'm saying is making more accessible and why you asked that question, but
something really concrete that goes right along those lines is that the Army Corps attributes the competitive edge of U.S. grain production to the engineering of the Mississippi River. And this seems to be borne out by the ways that in Brazil they're trying to create more navigable rivers because shipping grain on a river is so for that you need a 9-foot channel, and that 9-foot channel explains the entire upper river, and so that sort of investment that structures the land is what makes this gigantic scale grain production possible, because there's a market for it. It's cheap because it's subsidized by that very construction, by the construction of the levees, and then by a million other forms of things.
But I would to follow up on what Ryan said, I don't think runs on synthetic nitrogen, which is, which drains out of that system, is leached out of the soil, goes down the river, creates a dead zone, which I'm sure you've heard of, in the Gulf of Mexico, and also the loss of topsoil goes through the river. But this kind of farming kind of engineers that loss in that dead zone.
You know, that's part of it, but yeah, can't forget that. I'm also really interested in the distinction between where just where the drift is. That's an example of a contemporary agricultural practice organized around.
I think we were talking about this in the park. So there's river time when you're on in the canoes and you give yourself kind of up to the river in a way, and you perceive landscape differently. Mm-hmm. It's a different mode of perception. And then now being in the car. And going from, where were we?
Driftless.
The drift, Baraboo, all the way to coming here. It's a different time, it's a different mode of perception, the fields are larger, you get a different sense of, like being in a car, it's really annoying, now knowing what it's like to be in a canoe. It's very, people want to come in, because there's people who've been on this journey much longer than I have. To some extent, this landscape is familiar to me, because I come from Austria, and we have also agriculture. There's also maize that's grown there, and different kinds of grains, but the scale here is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
So I can relate, and then I can't relate, and that's it's weird, because I don't quite have access to a register to articulate this. And, you know, I can't help have an ethnographic look on things, because this is a different culture to where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
So this is layered on top of, like, spending a lot of energy trying to keep my shit together, like different bags, and bags in bags.
I can relate so much, because I leave college field-based bicycle tours.
Yeah.
We spend a month traveling across the state of Montana on bicycle, and it's just such a different way of experiencing the landscape, and I think it just kind of ties into the conversations we've had about how we move across the landscape, how we walk, what our mindset is as we're moving, hearing new stories we're telling, and I think the opportunity that students have to be on the river is great to be altering that. I keep thinking too about this place. This is like where time zones originated.
Mm.
This is where, like, grain became abstracted from. Does
too, like, your narrative of, like, the experience of, like, moving, like, through the river has been, like, kind of missing for me in, like, the conference, you know, and it's actually, like, because I've lived in this country my whole life, but I've never experienced it in that way. I've never canoed down the Mississippi River, you know, so, and I've only lived in the Midwest for 2 years, so I'm catching up, too, you know, and it actually, like, you know, to have just an open discussion about how you're experiencing, like, that travel on top of, like, car travel, on top of, like, experiencing these, like, massive fields, you know, the agriculture at the scale for the first time is really, like, fascinating.
And like I said, there's people on this journey that have been there much longer than I have and can tell much richer stories.
I would love to hear, too, like, how what we're talking about connects to the first field station, because I didn't have a chance to go to the first field station.
Identification of Lake Itasca as the headwaters of the Mississippi River is so subject to Western technoscience and geography that contrasts very distinctly with indigenous conceptions of what the headwaters of the Mississippi River are. For example, we talked with an activist lawyer with
Frank Ebo,
who insists that within his tribe of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, that the headwaters of the Mississippi is actually Leech Lake, not Lake Itasca, because it has more, it fits better within their conception of the importance of that lake to the river, and their relationship to that river system. So there's that part, and then there's a couple of week break, that also involved a paddle from Lake Itasca down to Bemidji, and then there was a second set of events that we organized in and around the Twin Cities. And so what was the galvanizing issue in those projects in and around the Twin Cities had to do with the possibility for dam removal within the Twin Cities. There's three locking dams on the Mississippi in the Twin Cities, and the Army since, and this goes back to Brian's point, since those locking dams no longer fulfill their original federal mandate that was given to them, given to the Army Corps of Engineers, namely to facilitate commercial traffic. They were told by Congress in 2000, like a couple of years ago, 2017, maybe even earlier, that they need to decide what the future of the locking dam infrastructure is. And one of the biggest lobbying efforts in and around those locking dams is their potential removal. And so a lot of the research and projects had to do with the possibility for dam removal, and then also
How do they connect?
Yeah, oh, it's very nice. It's very time for the river.
It's kind of like a psychosocial moratorium, like being on the river. Yeah. Like taken out of your usual time and space and conventions.
That what we've been doing in Field Station 2 to what your experience has been, you know, like, I mean, that's not a test, but rather, you know, rather just because since, rather than say, oh, well, you have river experiences in isolation, you know, from this experience, I just wonder if, has it just been sort of confounding, or has it been sort of like, well, you can put that together with maybe some of the things we learned in ICASTA, you know, at the biological research station, and those conversations that John was just kind of summarizing, you know. And, I mean, I'd just love to hear from anybody in but also anybody who's been on the river and then encountered this, you know, because I'm sure in some ways it's like, whoa, and now we're in the car.
I think I'm going to take this opportunity then to share a little bit about my experience so far on the river and a little bit about my background. I was on the 2018 River Semesters, and this is my second time traveling down to Mississippi, and I was also raised in the Minnesota River Valley. And the Minnesota River Valley, for those of you who aren't from this area, is about, I would say, 2.5 hours by car from Minneapolis, where Field Station 1 is, and it's also a place where John Deere and corn and soy are grown everywhere. And those are my people. I grew up in a town with 600 people in it that was surrounded by cornfields. We had a grain elevator. My Uncle Dan raises cattle and he has soybean fields. And I am sitting here and thinking very critically about who's in this circle and who isn't. And why are we outside of this place where obviously the global food industrial complex has so many negative impacts on the lives of so many people, those also being my people, from Southern Minnesota, and the plight of the American farmer, the fact that many of them are impoverished, many of them happen to be immigrants and small-scale farmers, and many of them don't have health care. My cousin Anna, who recently had twin babies, has to drive 45 minutes to get to the hospital, at least. And we're sitting here, I'm standing and sitting here, outside of this space that symbolizes that, but it's also the sort of, it's the way that that area and the town that I grew up in was founded, and also the reason that it's now dying, the reason that my community is declining. And we're sitting in a circle where we are all equals, but in one where our backs are turned to all of the other people who, that this issue is directly affecting behind us, and that voice isn't heard here. And so I'm grateful to be here to be able to share that. The other amazing thing about the river that I found in 2018 and also now in 2019 is how it just brings people together, you know, and how this amazing community